Right, the time has come now for questions and discussion. Just to remind people, if they don't know, that the way to actually ask a question or make a contribution is to click on the reactions label at the bottom of the screen and then on raise hand. And we've got a couple of people already who've done that. And we can take it from here then. Right, first of all, Paul Bennett, over to you.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. One point I'd like to make about dirty work. I thought what you said about that was absolutely fine and very good. But one point I like to make that with regard to that is to ask, what is dirty work? And I think the real dirty work is working as a bailiff or a debt collector or a prison officer or someone who designs bombs and so on. And I know that isn't what the people who ask that question have in mind, but I think it's important to make them think about what is dirty work in the sense of unpleasant, anti-human work, and to say that that kind of work won't be necessary in socialism. I think you still have to make the kind of response that you made earlier, but I think getting these people to think about what is dirty work in the sense of anti-human, I think that's important too.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's like I always think that there are two arguments we always need to make. We have to make a negative argument and a positive argument. The argument against capitalism and the argument for a moneyless society. Let's stick to that phrase. And we need to actually make the contrast between the two. I think that's a brilliant sort of approach as well, you know, sort of another tool in the armory. Yeah, thanks for that.
That's Richard. Okay. Andy Davies, over to you now.
Thank you, Richard. That was a great talk. I can't praise it enough. The thing about that you mentioned about the, I think it was the, like, people you argue with from things like the Cato Institute and so on, people like that, or just the people who want to put up an argument against your very sensible position. They'll say, well, what if I want a yacht or so on? It just reminded me, actually, I'm going to sort of come from a very sort of like not very socialist sort of point, really. But earlier this year, Eileen and I went on a little holiday to Whitby, which is a coastal town. And the real heroes in that town are the RNLI, lifeboat people, who go out and risk their own lives to save the lives of other people. It doesn't matter who they are. They could be rich, they could be poor, they could be just working class fisher people, etc. But you know what? Those people are really regarded in like incredibly high esteem. You mentioned about status and so on. And the other thing I think that, I can't better what Paul said about things, with dirty jobs. But, I think being sort of pragmatic about that, I mean, most dirty jobs can be resolved, solved, made a lot better through technology, mechanization technology, et cetera, as well. These days and certainly in the future. But I suppose the other sort of bit I'm coming to as well is about other people who have status, even already in capitalism. That's people who do dangerous jobs. Who would want to do a dangerous job? But people do, don't they? People will be a fireman. People will be a copper. people will be, you know, they'll do things that are dangerous because it's got a certain status. Now, I know that there's a certain element of push because it's like, well, what else can I do kind of thing, you know. But I hope you get the gist of what I'm trying to say, really, about balancing out the aspect of the nonsense, really, about wanting sort of more than is due to you after capitalism is abolished. Sorry about that. I don't think I've made my point very well, but I know Richard quite well. I think he'll probably understand what I'm trying to say there.
Yeah, definitely, Andy. I mean, I think that's also a good point. And I think it's a useful point to again put in the sort of arsenal. we need, you know, there is a huge number of organizations out there proposing all kinds of things. You know, we've got a hell of a lot of competition these days. I mean, the days when we were just competing with the Leninists and the Trotskyists and the, you know, sort of, and the anarchists have way gone by. There's loads and loads of people now putting ideas out there for a post-capitalist society, many of which, you know, we would think would be disastrous because because of our analysis, from our point of view, our perspective, they wouldn't work. So we need to be actually getting our arguments out there sort of very loud and very clear. But I have a slight anxiety about promoting an argument from human nature. And that's not because I think it's a bad argument. I think it's a brilliant argument. Once you've got people on board, then I think you can promote it. This is my experience. But it's an easy argument for people to dismiss because people think in terms of, as I said, in terms of capitalist organization, capitalist ideas. And it's very easy, I've found, for people to say, oh, that's just your utopianism, thinking that people are going to be all lovey-dovey and wonderful, you know, once you've actually sort of changed society, and it's not going to work like that. And there are lots of arguments against that, but it's actually a slightly harder argument to actually deal with, and it can get very, very fuzzy very quickly. But no, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's a really important point. It's part of the arsenal we should be including. But just personally, I have a slight reluctance to put it forward as my primary argument to begin with. And I think the other thing is I'm a little anxious about talking about status in a socialist society. There may be status in a socialist society, which comes from doing these kind of tasks. What I know, though, about hunter-gatherers is that they do everything possible to actually eliminate any kind of status whatsoever, because for them, any kind of status leads to inequalities, which can lead them down the path towards a kind of non-egalitarian situation which they want to avoid. You know, Marx thought that hunter-gatherer societies kept themselves together unconsciously. They hadn't really understood why they did the things they did. But actually, that's not what ethnology, anthropology actually has discovered. Hunter-gatherer peoples are very, very astutely aware, acutely and astutely aware of how easily their egalitarian societies, which they wish to preserve, could be undermined by these things. And they consciously go out to avoid them. So that's just another kind of idea that I want to throw in the pot. I'm not saying that what you're saying is wrong. And, we don't know. There may well be people who do things like go out on the lifeboats or become firemen, might have a kind of special status in people's minds. We don't know. But, you know, that's just a kind of little question mark that I want to put there. Sorry, I'll try and make my answers shorter in future.
Okay, thanks, Richard. Brian, your turn now.
All right. You don't know how eager I've been, Richard, to get on here and listen to what you have to say, you know, because I'm so much into a moneyless society, and indeed, it was the idea of a moneyless society that brought me towards socialism and in contact with the Socialist Party of Great Britain. But anyway, I noticed that you didn't provide an example of a moneyless society to promote your talk at all. All your examples came from everyday capitalist society, of what we can do within capitalist society, etc. But then your last bit,
I can't hear you, Brian. You've gone.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
That's okay now.
Right. Your last bit there about the gatherer society, that prompted me to remember that there is, in fact, a moneyless society still in existence today. And it's on a tiny island, a very tiny island, in the Indian Ocean, which is, in fact, protected by the Indian government. They don't allow anybody to land there, right? No one at all is allowed to go there. The local fishermen have been told to stay clear of the locals, of the community, because they are very protective. And anybody that comes in very near is likely to have a spear or an arrow attached to their abdomen pretty quick, which was illustrated with the latest casualty from this community. And that was a Christian mission. Thought they were deprived of the Christian message, and that to bring about a more egalitarian society in his manner of thinking, he had to invade that society and introduce them to the concepts of religious, etc., etc. And he managed to provide or get two local fishermen to take him in as near as possible, right, to this island community. And, when he got into the shallows, right, the fishermen promptly dropped him off and started heading back to the mainland quickly, because they knew exactly what was going to happen, and that it did. Some of the local community was well aware of what was occurring, right, and they came out with the bows and arrows, and the Christian missionary was promptly turned into a porcupine pretty quick. So it just goes to show that they're willing. But, unfortunately, as well as not unfortunate, but they were well aware that any introduction by a member from the main society to their egalitarian community was going to upset the balance, right? Things was going to occur. The first thing being is that the introduction of diseases, right? That would definitely go on, etc. And then the other thing is that they'd be trying to introduce a non-sharing society, etc. Which is with non-sharing goes lack of cooperation, etc. It all falls in line, etc. So there you go. The unfortunate aspect of it is that we can't observe this society, what actually occurs. We've got to take our examples of what we've actually got on mainland capitalism, wherever anti-gatherers bands appear, and they're very small. And unfortunately, again, as we know from our own experience, once we introduce ourselves, right, things start disappearing from that band's behaviour, etc. The behaviour changes. I mean, this has been, well proven with the introduction to tourism in Thailand, in the mountain tribes, who are very banded and anti-gatherers and all the rest of it. They started taking tours up to these mountain tribes in Thailand and, to see what their behavior was and all the rest of it, and making money from it, And what actually happened was, you know, they were making money from it, and they had to turn around, pay these bands, right, to provide the entertainment for the tourists, right? And they knew that the more entertaining they made it, the more likelihood is that the next band of tourists, right, would come up and have a watch from, so that their money was more or less guaranteed. So what they did, they started introducing the entertainment which was most popular, right? And their behaviour actually changed. And in the end, the behaviour that they were illustrating for the tourists was, you know, completely different from the original behaviour that they started introducing. So it goes on, like, you know. I don't know whether you've heard of this little community in the Indian Ocean, but there are there that is still protected by the Indian government. So the state is doing actually quite a good job there, I think, you know. But there we go. Anyway, thank you, Richard. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Brian. Yeah, I think you were talking about the Andaman Islands.
That's the one.
Yeah, there are in fact still quite a number of moneyless societies around the world. They're mostly in Africa, but there's some in Southern Asia and in Southeast Asia. There's nearly a million people in just in the sub-Saharan Africa who are living still in a moneyless condition. A whole group of immediate return hunter-gatherers. There's people in southern India, the Hill Pandaram, there's the Palian, there's the Batek, there are a whole number of groups around the world that actually still have to be a little bit careful, because some of these moneyless groups are egalitarian and some of them are not. So you have to just be careful with which examples you choose. Not much is actually known about the Andaman Islanders, but they do appear to actually have at least a semi-egalitarian type of society. Until about the 1980s, anthropologists used to refer to any society as egalitarian if it had male egalitarianism, because a lot of these societies are egalitarian within the male community, but they are unequal between male and female. So you have to be careful with that. They now refer to really egalitarian societies as hyper-egalitarian societies. And the main point of interest in that is that most anthropologists, on the available evidence, take the view that these moneyless societies, these hyper-egalitarian societies, were actually the form that our ancestral societies took, that we actually lived in exactly those kinds of societies for tens of thousands of years, several hundred thousand years, in fact. So we do have examples that we use, and they are examples I do use sometimes, and it's worth getting to know them. And you know, if you want to get into these kind of conversations, anyone, it is useful to know them. But my experience is that, they are the sort of arguments that I like to present once I've started to get people on board. Because if they're cynical or any way, it's very easy for them to say, oh, you're talking about primitives. You know, it's like, I get this a lot. Now, you're just talking about primitives, you know, people who live in small groups. They don't actually live in small groups. Some of them live in very big groups. But it's very easy to put down. So I use those as a second line of argument rather than bring it up front. But yeah, that's really good point, Brian. Thank you.
Thanks, Richard. Freddie, over to you now.
Yeah, thanks, Howard. And hi, Richard. Richard, I mean, this is more connected with the meeting that you'd done in this group or this club or whatever it was you mentioned at the very outset. Because as you rightly pointed out at the beginning of your address this evening, I mean, you're largely talking to here, as you say yourself said. I think just about everybody that's on here that I can see anyway, are members of the party. and will have maybe one or two different variations in how they present the case, or when they're having a chat with people outside the party, trying to persuade them to become socialists, etc. So my thinking on this is, in other words, you're already talking to the converted here without meaning that in any sort of religious way.
No.
But so my thinking is, though, is that there must have been something impressive, notwithstanding the socialist case is impressive, but there must have been something impressive that you've been invited back again to speak next year sometime. I think you said May or March or May or whatever it was. There must have been something there that has struck a chord with a number of people in order to invite you back again, which of course is encouraging. Because my other observation at this time is that it was only at the very end of tonight's address or tonight's speech that you actually mentioned Marx at all.
Yes.
Well, it is. Now, yeah. I find that quite interesting. And it was only at the end, well, twice you've mentioned them tonight, but at the very end of your speech, you mentioned Marx at one point there. And I was wondering, going back to the meeting you had with this group that you were addressing, it's pretty much you put the socialist case to them, weren't you, about this moneyless society. That's what it was. So what is it you feel has struck the chord that perhaps other members could learn from when having discussions? Because, as I say, when we recently had a public meeting in Sheffield 2-3 months ago now, the speaker then hardly mentioned Marx at all. Hardly mentioned them, only at the end, again, a bit like yourself. And when we were talking about it afterwards, I'm paraphrasing now to some extent, why Marx wasn't mentioned to the extent that perhaps historically I'd certainly heard them getting mentioned, is that some people seem to get turned off as soon as you start mentioning Karl Marx. And I was wondering if that's why you did the address the way in which you done it. And as I say, ultimately, what it is you think you feel has influenced them, the thinking, to ask you back for more. But I've enjoyed what you said, Richard. Thanks.
I've given enough talks now, both to the party and to groups outside the party, to kind of begun to develop a style. And based on my kind of experience and like what I'm noticing. And there are several things there. No, I never mention Marx in when I'm giving an address to a public group, because, as you say, a lot of people have a knee-jerk reaction to it. I will only mention Marx if somebody actually brings it up. And actually, usually people do. Somebody will say, oh, is that like what Marx was saying? And I'll say, yeah, actually, it's not dissimilar from what Marx was saying. So I'm not actually saying, look at me, I'm a Marxist. I can say to them, yeah, it's similar to what Marx was saying. Or yeah, Marx was saying something like that. I make a point of not actually sort of saying, I'm a Marxist, this is a Marxist position. And another thing that I do is I don't mention the word socialism. I actually had difficulty when I gave the talk in Letchworth not doing that, because I'm so used to doing it. I constantly kept catching myself about to do it and saying instead a moneyless society, you know. And that actually kind of people are anxious about the world in which they live, I think. Even when they're kind of bit bullish about it, underneath you can often hear that anxiety. And they're anxious about what, you know, so what to do about it. So they don't want to, I don't want to get them caught up in any kind of knee-jerk reactions about Marx, which have nothing to do, and assumptions about Marx, which have nothing to do with what I'm trying to present to them. I think on this occasion, I've had a little bit of feedback. I was presenting an idea to them, which was so completely new that to many of them, that they were just kind of blown away by it. This was something they'd never heard before, an idea that they'd never even considered. And when I tried to pick it apart to show that it was actually possible, I think that really... that really did gel with them, and they wanted to know more. That's why I got back, asked back, because they wanted to know more.
Thanks, Richard. Right, Mike Foster's next in the queue, but we do have a question on the chat. Don't know if you've seen it, Richard, which says, what are the primary organisations promoting a moneyless society at this time?
All right, okay. Well, very quickly, I mean, there's two old friends of ours. Well, they're either friends or enemies, depends on the view you take. There's the Zeitgeist movement, and there's the Venus Project. These two organizations are global organizations, so they're pretty massive, even though they've shrunk over recent years because they've had there has been a lack of movement. And the initial enthusiasm that emerged when they first emerged has kind of reduced also. But there are other organizations. A number of these organizations, a number of these movements get built around books that people write. So, for example, Howard and I at the beginning of the talk were talking about the work of Matt Holton and his book Moneyless Society. And he's got a really big website on there as well. And they're actually now developing a big movement built around them. Now, they're gradualists. They actually believe that by introducing little moneyless schemes everywhere around the world, they can grow and grow and somehow finally take over capitalism, not realizing that at some point they're going to come up against the interests of the capitalist class, and they're going to need more than that. They're going to need a worldwide movement of working class people who are prepared, who are still working in the capitalist economy, the main capitalist economy, and are prepared to say no more. And they are going to sort of have to say that, you know, we no longer accept your contract and start taking over the factories for themselves, or whatever the business things. So Matt's group is, I've talked to them. They're a nice bunch of people. Some of them a bit sort of spaced out, but Matt himself is quite good. And Matt is really interesting because he's into systems analysis, which is interestingly a bit like dialectics. Not a lot, but it does have the same idea that it treats things as a whole and tries to see all the interconnections. Then there's newer, they're not newer. There's other organizations that are proposing a moneyless society. There's something called Copiosis, which seems to have also to be global, to have groups emerging all around the world. There are quasi moneyless societies as well. They want to have a moneyless society, but they want to have an alternative to money, which so whereby people still get points or credits for certain things. You know, a bit like labor time vouchers that sort of Marx talked about, but not necessarily based on labor, based on other things other than labor. You get credits, so you can buy luxuries with them, whereas everything else is made free. Basics are made free, but you can earn luxuries by doing good things, for example, by providing social benefits. And a lot of those are tied into a kind of introduced by techies. There's another group called Parallel Monetary Economy that wants that alongside a monetary economy. So there's a choice of things. But I've just been talking to to Adam today. I'm going to do another talk on all those organisations in January. So if anybody's interested, I don't want to take up too much time now. If anybody's interested, I'll be talking about them then.
Thanks, Richard. Mike Foster, over to you now.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Richard, for a very thought-provoking talk, as always, and interesting discussion so far. I was thinking of arguments that people might come up with in favour of a money society, and forgive me if I've missed where you've already countered this one. In that, some people might argue that money is an effective way of regulating the distribution of inherently scarce things, such as antiques or finite minerals, works of art, maybe. In the they've got a high value because that reflects their scarcity, and the intention is that because they've got a high monetary cost, that decreases demand. I'm guessing that's the argument, and that the continuation of that is that a socialist society would have difficulty in ensuring that there wasn't more demand. Again, the word demand has got capitalist connotations, for things like antiques or rare minerals. I can't sort of quite articulate I'm sure there's a socialist counter argument to that, but I was wondering you could perhaps expand on that issue a little. Also, as well, another thought popped into my head that, and again, it's something that you covered, that defining something by a negative, by what it isn't, you're not always off on the best foot. A moneyless society, you're defining something by what it isn't. And of course, the positive other side of the coin of that is to, describe a society of free access, world of free access. And I think with that, it's worth remembering that, free as in free access has got, quite a clever double meaning. It means free as in no payment, no monetary payment required, but also got free as in, the meaning of freedom. And I think as, hopefully when the world does shift to a moneyless society, I'm guessing the word, free access as a concept, it'll just become a given in the way that, a money society is seen as a given now. And I think as well, the sort of meaning that we attach to words like, price, value, money, those words will become quite sort of bizarre in a future society, won't they? They'll have lost their immediate meaning, and they'll be seen as sort of a vague, almost sort of superstitious notion. Anyway, I'm starting to ramble, so I'll wrap it up there. Yeah, thank you.
That's a good point, Mike. I've forgotten what I was going to say about it now, which is probably a good idea because I shall ramble on myself if I think about it. What were you saying? You were saying, in terms of presenting a negative view of, sort of what socialism or what a moneyless society isn't, I think that's a good point. My take on this is that if you're presenting a moneyless society to somebody, you first of all have to keep it really, really simple. And that's why I try to focus on the basic social relations of a moneyless society. There would be no buying and selling, there would be no wages, so once you've got that across, then you can expand and you can start to sort of bring in more ideas about how such a society might function. You always have to sort of course treat it as a speculative idea. And anyway, we can't really talk about how a moneyless society would function beyond those simple elements, simply because we don't know. And, it's like such a society. I mean, we always move forward by trial and error. So they would be trying things out. And, you know, if they tried something out and it worked, they would do it again. And if it didn't work, they wouldn't do it again. So things would change over time as it developed. And also, you won't necessarily do the same thing in different parts of the world. You know, if you had, if you got over in a mountainous, cold region, certain things may not work, which would happen in a hot sort of tropic region or anything else like that. So there would, I think, be lots of variety. So hard to say. Yeah, but it's a good point. But my approach would be to take it, sort of start very simple and take it step by step.
Thanks, Richard. Okay. It's Dougie next.
Hi. Yeah. I mean, I thought it was an interesting talk, Richard. Yeah. Well, what I would say is, I mean, there's some skilled jobs that are quite dirty in terms of messy or whatever, like brain surgery or, we're patching people up because of capitalism's wars or whatever. And I'd say that war is one of the dirtiest things that happens in capitalism, and you wouldn't get that in a socialist society. So I don't know. I mean, I just think, there's things that happen in capitalism that won't happen in a moneyless society. You won't get people killing each other like they're doing in the Middle East or whatever, and like they do in other parts of the world. So that's one of the dirtiest things that goes on. And people end up with PTSD. And I mean, I think in Vietnam and things, there was a lot of American soldiers came back and killed themselves. There's a lot of suicide because of what they've been through in war situations. And, we can point that out to people, and say you won't get that in a cooperative society. Anyway, I enjoyed your talk, Richard. Thanks.
Yeah.
Shall we go straight on to Andy then, Richard?
Yeah, by all means. Yeah.
It's not a very deep point that I wanted to make, really, but it was just really about whether there's any purchase in another kind of little tool in the toolbox and possibly sort of propaganda point as well, is there's ever more sort of debate, discussion, in sort of the media now about, this cashless society and the problems that a cashless society is going to present for people, particularly people who aren't, able necessarily to access banks or pay bills online and all that type of thing. I just wondered if it was an inroad there just as an opening to get our message across to the mainstream on that. And just that was all, really. Thanks.
It's interesting you should say that because five people who came to the talk thought they were going to get a talk about a cashless society. And actually, they were some of the most enthusiastic about the idea of moneyless society afterwards. So I got them there on false pretenses. But having done so, they got the message, which was quite interesting.
Thanks, Richard. Okay, Brian, you again.
Red, thanks for that. I thought I just should point out that, Richard, you was looking for it. You and Freddie was looking for the reason why so many people appeared at the meeting in that locality. I forgot what he said it was now. I think it was about 30-odd people turned up. Am I correct?
I thought it was about 35, but I'm told there were over 40.
Oh, right, okay, right. Well, I think from my experience anyway, right, the reason why they turned up is because you did not publicise any political party affiliation.
There
you are. I hit that right on the head there.
Yeah,
I thought it was true, yeah. Because that's been my experience as well. when I've given talks, I've been asked to give talks in the past, right, to various organisations, well, mainly the Zeitgeist movement, right? I give several talks in the Zeitgeist movement, you know, and I did it under non-party affiliation, etc. And I mean, at one meeting, I had 100+ people, right, on TeamSpeak listening in. You know, and it was very interesting. You know, and it was a simple talk, on a medical society. It was just saying, what would you do? Right, posing the question to the audience, so they had to come back to me, right? What would you do, right, in a medical society, etc.? What I found the trend was that it was young males coming forward, right, and saying what they would do in a moneyless society. And what they would do, the majority of them, is travel the world. Mm. In other words, to gain experience from other people. That's what it's about. They didn't look at themselves as tourists as such, but just as travellers, right? And that meant staying as long as they thought necessary in that particular locality to gain from the cultural experience, etc., etc., or perhaps learn the language, right? But, like I say, the trend was the males, generally speaking, you know, and the younger males who was in favour of the benefits of a moneyless society pass, or the one benefit as they'd seen it, right? They possibly didn't recognise the other immense benefits which would be available for them, and the freedom of choice and to go and do and participate and contribute and share whichever particular society that they were in, because they would all, that particular society would also be a moneyless society and not just their own personal experience, which would be moneyless, you know. So, yes, like I say, non-party affiliation does have its benefits, you know. Having said that, that reminds me as well, it picks up, you know, with the party being in obvious decline, right, these days, is that if the party was to die, it would be the party would be dying, not the ideas behind the party. And if it was to die, may a thousand flowers bloom. That's what I say, because what would occur then is we'd all have to get up from our asses and actually do something positive to contribute to getting the idea organized again, because that's the unfortunate part of it. You know, if the party was to die, right, the organization will go. And it's very important that when you have an idea like you have for socialism, right, that you have organized activity around it. That's the main thing. But we've got a lot to look forward to if we're still around, that is, you know, a moneyless society, you know. Thank you, Richard.
Yeah,
and also thank you for confirming that there is non-party affiliation that attracts the working public, you know, to ideas on socialism. Thank you.
Yeah, I think
can I just say, Brian, the party's not dying. Don't keep saying it. You sound as though you want to bring it upon us. Please don't keep saying that. Sorry, Richard.
I actually I never introduce the party. I never mention the party when I give a talk initially. What I do is I have a list of reading material for people to pick up afterwards, in which I include quite a lot of party pamphlets and references to the party, as well as to some neutral information about anything that I've actually been talking about. So, because we're in a different world today than we were sort of 30, 40, 50 years ago. If you go online and you look at the kind of websites that you find up there, you will find that all kinds of people are interested in all kinds of ideas, but they do not want to be recruited. So if they're going to be recruited, it's going to be on their terms. You've got to let them find out about you and what you represent. And when they do that, they are much more willing and much more feel much more free to actually step forward and say, "I am interested. Tell me more." You know, you want to get people to say, "Tell me more." So in the course of this talk and like other talks that I've given outside the party, what I've actually said is that towards the end of it, because generally people ask me, I say, well, I'm a member of an organization called the Socialist Party of Great Britain that's been putting these ideas around for a long, long time. But I don't actually present that as I'm speaking on behalf of the party. I let them come to me, and some of them want to know more afterwards. A couple of people came to asking to know more afterwards. But so I don't promote it because people don't want it. People are suspicious of other people trying to recruit them. And what they do is they double down. They put up their resistances. So maybe it means that fewer people find out about the party, but those that do are often much more amenable to finding out about it and to kind of looking further into it. Yeah, that's my philosophy anyway. I mean, you may have, or people may have an alternative view, but that's what I think at the present time.
Thanks, Richard. Pastor Paddy now.
Just on a question. It's a bit of a trivial question. But
you're very muddy, Paddy.
I'm not hearing you very well, Paddy. You've gone all together now, I think. We can't hear you at all, Paddy.
All right, we'll just leave it.
Oh, hang on.
There you are. You're back.
We heard that, yeah.
Did you? Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's all right.
That's much better.
Oh, right. I think maybe I need to get some new equipment. This is getting a bit old. All right, okay, yeah. So what I was trying to say was I just had a kind of fairly trivial question, which I'll ask first because you can dispose of that, which is I was actually quite taken by Mike Foster's question about, you know, money as a medium for rare goods and what you do about that. That wasn't my question. My immediate thought went, I immediately thought of, oh, yeah, well, then there's smart asses with the economic calculation argument. And then and I thought, now, I really like the way that you've sort of structured this. And I totally get what you're saying about keeping it simple and then introducing stuff later. So I like the way that you're sort of, you know, you're graduating the approach. I think that's very clever. And I just wonder, just offhand, what do you do in situations where you've got some smart aleck in the audience who goes, oh, well, I've read a bit of Hayek or von Mises, and what do you do about it? I mean, that must be a bit of a nightmare. But I suppose you have to kind of, don't know. So that was my question first, what you did about that. My other thing I wanted to say was an observation of something that we haven't sort of, that hasn't so far been thought about, which might actually be helpful if you're putting, when you're putting these arguments about what do you do about the lazy people. I think that whenever I've had this question and you talk to people generally, people seem to have this kind of unspoken assumption that if we're not all out there 16 hours a day tilling the fields or grinding out grommets in a factory, society's going to collapse and we're all going to starve in the gutter. But actually, when you look at the news today, everybody's panicking about AI taking all the jobs away. You know, not just in manufacturing, but also in the sort of so-called middle-class jobs. And I wonder if sometimes, you know, as socialists, I know we don't want to bang on about Marx all the time, but we do sort of talk about, and I noticed you doing this a lot, you talk about productive jobs, you talk about production all the time. And, of course, production is really important. We need production, no question. But, you know, productive work in Marx's terms is sort of, well, it's making creating surplus value, but he's making stuff for other people, whereas services, he's doing stuff for other people. And just out of interest, I had a quick look at online for, you know, what is the proportion of the population doing each of these. And I was actually a bit taken aback because in the UK in the last 10 years, according to Statista, 1.03% of the workforce is employed in agriculture. That's producing all the food. Just under 18% are in manufacturing. And the rest, sort of 80%, are in services. Well, if you think of how many of those services must be related to the sort of management of capitalism itself, you're seeing an absolutely massive wipeout of all of that service sector. At the moment, almost nobody is involved in agriculture, and only one-fifth of people are in manufacturing, which is steadily being further and further automated. So I think a possible alternative answer to the lazy question is, actually, we might need people to be a bit more lazy because there might not be enough work to go around. I think people may start to see work as a bit of a privilege. Oh, I've got the chance to do some actually useful work this week, actually productive work for a change. Won't that be great? What a change. So I think you could argue that the way things are going, in a socialist society, it would be some effort to find work, And people would have to find their own amusements and create all sorts of interesting services and doing stuff for other people that we probably haven't even thought of yet. So, you know, there you go. There's that about it.
No. God, there's an awful lot there, Paddy. When I gave this talk, I did actually deal with this. I cut it all out. I cut out. I mean, I talk for an hour and a quarter, as I'm wont to do in this thing. It seemed to be all right, but I was trying to cut this down to an hour. So I left out quite a lot about the idea that, there would be a superfluity of labour. I went through the usual SBGB thing. I had a long list of industries and jobs related purely to the monetary system, which I think is a good argument, and I think it is one that makes a big impact. Lots of people sort of commented on that, so that was quite impactful. In terms of I'll try and keep these brief. In terms of scarcity and money being useful for scarcity, I think the answer to that I've given in the past has generally been that there is one quite interesting organization out there is called Library Socialism, and it's an interesting movement out there, and they imagine society cutting right back in terms of personal possessions and everything being available at a library of goods of various sorts of things. So if you wanted to cut your grass, instead of everyone in the street having a lawnmower, you would actually go along to your lawnmower library or your gardening library, and you would take out a lawnmower, and it could be for yours for as long as you were using it. And when you got fed up with it, you could take it back. The fact of it is, with scarce goods, the problem is that we're in capitalism with the monetary system. What it actually means that, yes, it does. It does have a way of distributing scarce goods to wealthy people, basically. So it doesn't actually get passed around. But the library system, where they might hire it out for a certain period, would be a good solution to that. So everyone who was interested in having access to that might be good. Actually, one of the interesting things about a lot of these organizations, a lot of these movements that are coming up, is that although their ideas, their economic ideas, I think, are unworkable, they often have practical ideas which would work very well within the context of a moneyless socialist society. So we should be actually looking at them and sort of giving them the respect that they deserve on that. There is something for, you mentioned agriculture, there is something called regenerative agriculture, which is now going on beyond the idea of sustainable agriculture and recovering the soil. Over 50% of the soil is now denuded is now unproductive, of the world's soil is now unproductive. They want to, they have the ideas of ways in which that can be regenerated. Now, George Monbiot has said, oh, well, this is, he's written a whole book on it, saying, oh, well, this could never work because it would be too labour intensive. And because what he means, it would be too labour intensive for capitalism, but it would work very well within a socialist society and would allow us to actually bring the land back up to its productive and long-term sustainable potential. The lazy person, one of the things I cut out here, which I think is always a good argument, is I say to people, and don't go sounding off against the lazy person, because you too might want to be lazy. You know, you too might want to travel around the world. That's exactly the example that I use, maybe to broaden your mind. This is a society whose only purpose is to provide for social needs. And that's not exclusively economically providing for the things. That is something that is actually going to make life fulfilling and meaningful and purposeful for people at all level. It means transcending the realm of necessity, the things that we must do in order to survive, to widen the realm of freedom, which is what we can do to survive and to live in full, more fulfilling ways. So I think that's really interesting. In terms of the percentage of people involved, what really struck me, a figure that I found recently that was really, really interesting, is that I can't remember the exact figure. This is only just an approximation to what I remember. But of the world's population, of the world's population of working age, 23% today work in the formal economy. Think about that. So you're 1.3% agriculture, 18.6% manufacturing, 80% service, is only 1.3%, 18%, and 80% of 23% that are actually doing those tasks. Most of the world's population actually still work in an informal economy, doing jobs for one another, which is, I thought, was quite interesting. There was something else, but I can't remember, and I probably should shut up now. So, okay. Great, Paddy. Brilliant. Thanks.
Could I ask a quick question? Just what was that agriculture book that you mentioned, Richard? I'd be interested.
Oh, it's not a book. It's a movement.
A movement.
It's called, you can find it online. I think there is a book that they produced. It's called Regenerative Agriculture. And this is not a small organization. It's a global organization. It is largely composed of farmers who are doing the most incredible research all around the world in their own particular ecological niches, because there is no one solution sorts all. And they actually have a global fair once a year, a global conference once a year. And the reason I found out about this is that this year, it actually happened only about a month ago. It took place in the village where I was born, on a Lanark farm, where they had hundreds and hundreds of stalls where I used to play and sort of in the bales and destroy the bales in the farmers' fields as kids building houses with them and everything. This is a big organization, and it is actually really well worth paying attention to. Sorry, in my view. Yeah, anyway.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's getting towards 9:30. The clock behind you, by the way, is a bit slow, Richard, I think. Getting towards 9:30, I'm inclined to draw the session to a close. We're later than we usually are. Nobody's got their hands up at the moment. But perhaps can I just abuse my position just to say a quick word myself, since I've not really said anything so far. First of all, to agree entirely about this this terminology thing, this precipitate use of words like socialism and Marxism and so on, more likely to put people off than anything else. I'm not saying we should hide it forever, by no means. No. A good example of this, very quickly, is that Matthew Holton, who you mentioned, the author of the book called Moneyless Society, at a very early stage, I received an online copy of the book, and I read it, and I was in contact with him. He said, would I do one of these endorsements, which they could put on the back cover? And I did. It was something sort of very, very positive, except it's on the back cover from Howard Moss, Socialist Party of Great Britain. He was in touch with me not so long ago. I think they're doing a second edition. He says, socialist isn't good. People are put off by it. Can you give yourself a different sort of affiliation? And I said, yeah, if you like. So my affiliation now, the one I sent to him, is Honorary Fellow, Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences, Swansea University, UK. He got back to me and said, that's perfect. So there we are. That's a prime example of the kind of thing you're talking about, Richard.
Yeah. Definitely.
It is the States, after all. It's the United States as well.
Yeah,
the only other thing I wanted to say was that I've been thinking that somebody should do a talk called something like We Are Not Alone. And you're just about to do it, Richard, you said, next month. Great.
Yep.
Exactly what sort of passed through my mind. That'd be great. I really look forward to that. And I think we must try and sort of publicise it as much as possible as well. Thanks very much. Okay, well, since nobody else has got their hands up, can I thank Richard for an excellent, wide-ranging, I was going to say provocative talk. It wasn't really provocative. I think most of us agree with most of what he says. And draw it to a close, and we'll look forward to seeing everyone next week, hopefully.